haven't agreed with the governor on every issue that she has out there. Certainly been an opponent of some, and I've supported her on others.
The new leadership takes shape in the state legislature. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, the 6th of November. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, a village-based women's shelter struggles to continue providing services.
I'm worried about how things are going to be this winter. We're going to do what we can to keep the shelter open.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company.
The State House and Senate today organized their majority coalitions, even though the vote tallies in six House districts and one Senate district are still so close, the final outcome could change before the session begins. As it now stands, 10 Republicans and 10 Democrats hold Senate seats in the session that begins in January. The 10-10 split has so far brought together a 13-member bipartisan majority with Kodiak's Gary Stevens as president. All 10 Democrats and three of the Republicans are in the group. Stevens said the coalition has agreed the only things that won't be addressed are those that come from the extreme right and extreme left of the political spectrum.
Realizing that you've got to get to 11 votes on the Senate floor, it's very hard to do that. So all I can say is that those issues that are extreme will probably not be addressed. Just as last 2 years and the 25th legislature, we were unable to address the extreme issues. So it's clearly a move towards the center, an attempt with a bipartisan coalition to deal with those issues we can and not deal with those issues that are divisive among us.
Joining Stevens in the leadership positions will be Anchorage's Johnny Ellis as majority leader, Charlie Huggins from the MATSU as rules chairman, and Lyman Hoffman of Bethel and Bert Stedman of Sitka as co-chairs of finance. Stevens said the group agreed on several common goals that bring them together. He says the major one is energy, in-state supplies of fuel for Alaskans, as well as assistance with costs and conservation measures. He adds education priorities to the list as well as the need for a state fiscal plan that would soften the impact of oil price fluctuations on state spending. Finance co-chair Stedman says this year's budget will not be a problem for the Senate to deal with, describing an $800 million surplus in the Constitutional Budget Reserve, other money in various funds, and high revenue for the first quarter of this year.
We have amassed a substantial savings account. It's piled up quite high. The idea here is to extend the life of that savings as long as possible. So we'll see in the spring when we do our budget how the tea leaves look. But there is no interest in moving into the savings account any time that is not absolutely necessary to meet our operating obligations and to meet a federal match capital budget.
Asked by reporters if there was any intention of taking action next year on the Legislative Council investigation of Governor Palin and her firing of Public Safety Commissioner Walt Monaghan, Stevens said the Senate has already taken all the action he anticipates, releasing the report to the public and to the state officials who would have authority to take any further action on it. The only member of last year's bipartisan coalition who is not aligned with the new majority is Anchorage Republican Liesl McGuire. The House has also announced its leadership structure and most of its committee chairmanship positions. Mike Chenault of Nikiski is Speaker. Joining us from Juneau is APRN's Dave Donaldson. Hi, Dave.
Hi there.
Dave, besides Representative Chenault, who else will be in the leadership in the House?
Ketchikan's Kyle Johansson is going to be the majority leader. He takes the place of Ralph Samuels, who retired this year from Ralph was from Anchorage. The rules chairman will continue as John Coghill from North Pole. Finance, two totally new people for the leadership there. Mike Hawker from Anchorage and Bill Stoltz from Chugiak. Both of those have been on the committee in the past. They are very versed in finance activities, but they're new to that particular position. They're returning with Jay Ramirez as the judiciary chairman. Former, or by then will be former Speaker, John Harris of Valdez, who's had two terms as Speaker of the House, he will be in charge of the Legislative Council, which is becoming a more and more important and influential position, in that it deals with everything when the session is not, when the legislature is not in session, anything pretty well goes to the Legislative Council. It also gives out the parking permits, which at the Capitol is one of the most important jobs in the building.
Well, interestingly, there are still six House districts that are just too close to call yet. Are Republicans still confident with these assignments?
They are. They are not making those that it looks like they're not going to make it, or at least not at this point. And they are also leaving open. That's why they didn't release everything. But there are still some people that they hope can come in and take up a few positions in committee chairmanships that are not yet announced.
Well, Dave, the Senate has a bipartisan coalition. Is there any thought of expanding the Republican group?
Yeah, there have been some Democrats, and won't go into them by name because they may not get allowed to join. Right now, they're going to consider them kind of one by one as to who they are, which Republicans don't like any individual Democrats that have asked to join them. But there will be at least some consideration of them.
Well, what sort of priorities can we expect?
Well, it is a conservative group. It's a group that's real high on development, that's real high on looking at some of the jobs and financial things, and it's the traditional Republican priorities are going to be on the table. They'll probably bring up an awful lot of subjects that are not going to be considered by the Senate bipartisan coalition, but they will have them there. I think that we can expect just to see an awful lot more spending issues of development, jobs, and fiscal responsibility stuff. So that's the sort of things that we expect to see priorities.
All right, Dave, thank you.
My pleasure.
APRN's Dave Donaldson reporting from Juneau. Governor Palin doesn't have the same level of popularity she once enjoyed in the state, and that change will likely extend to her previously strong backing in the legislature as well. KSKA's Len Anderson talked with some lawmakers on just what kind of legislative homecoming she can expect.
Eagle River Senator Republican Fred Dyson retained his District I seat by tallying 70% of the votes against his Democratic challenger, Steve Amundson. For Dyson, it was a successful campaign season, but not necessarily a happy one.
Certainly, this is the ugliest campaign on a national level and on a local level that I've ever seen or recognized, and that's sad.
Dyson was speaking of inter-party strife, but newly re-elected South Anchorage District 31 representative, Republican Bob Lynn, was also concerned about intra-party squabbling.
Sometimes it makes a person wonder, do we have Republican Democrats or do we have Palinistas and Mikulskiites? The Palin election for governor is over. Get over it. Let's move ahead. The race for the presidency is over. I was disappointed, but let's move ahead. And I don't think it does any good for the state to be fighting past political battles. We need to look to the future.
Lynn, who describes himself as a staunch Palin supporter, thinks any rancor existing from the vice presidential campaign will be offset by newly acquired gubernatorial skills.
Whatever deficits she might suffer because of the past presidential race, she will gain because of the experience of working with all manner of people. She has a much broader spectrum of experience than she had before. To me, the bad news is she didn't win vice president. The good news is we got our governor back.
District T Senator Donald Olson, a Democrat, represents a broad swath of Alaska's north, from Nunavak Island and across the Arctic Nana region and North Slope to the Canadian border. Olson ran unopposed for a third term. He agrees a changed Palin will now work differently with the legislature.
There is going to be a new relationship. I think she sees something from a different perspective than she had before, now that she's been a national candidate and been on the international scene to a certain degree, and in rubbing shoulders with people of that caliber makes her a more sophisticated person and somebody that's looking out maybe 2 years, 4 years from now and going to be going on from there.
Anchorage's District M Senator, Democrat Hollis French, attributes any harsh feelings emanating from the vice presidential campaign as coming mainly from others than the governor.
You know, a lot of that was done, by the governor's surrogates. And I think we can put the election behind us, look forward, and be Alaskans solving problems.
French, who ran unopposed for a third term, looks to the Senate itself to foster a spirit of inter-party cooperation. This is Len Anderson.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, Alaska Airlines passenger recounts a recent emergency landing.
You could hear people crying, and I think everyone was kind of in their own little headspace.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
First National Bank Alaska, branches in 18 communities around the state and on the web at fnbalaska.com. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
From resource issues to recreational activities, APRN brings you the up-to-date information you need for life in Alaska.
With the recent declines in the stock market, the state employee retirement funds, known as PERS and TERS, have sustained big losses. KDLG's Adam Kane has the story.
Many state of Alaska employees have seen losses to the public employees retirement system and teachers retirement system. That loss is directly linked to the serious financial crisis that is currently gripping the nation. With the entire stock market in a serious decline, state employees may have expected to see greater losses than what they have actually seen at this point. The full impact of the decline has so far been lessened by the diversified investment portfolio chosen by the board at the Department of Revenue, as Chief Investment Officer Gary Bader explains.
Well, like all investments this year, the PERS and TERS funds have experienced losses. With the stock market down about 28%, the PERS and TERS funds are down about 17% because we have a diversified investment portfolio that is not just stocks, but bonds and other assets as well. So we are having a difficult year in the markets like everybody else.
The PERS and TERS are among the numerous state investment fund programs that Bader oversees. He says strictly adhering to the strategic plan is one of the ways the investment board has so far worked to curb the losses.
The way we structure our investment program is intended to curb the loss, and as I had previously said, we are not down as much as the stock market. So we attempt to curb our losses by having a diversified investment program and sticking with our strategic plan that is adopted once a year by the Alaska Retirement Management Board. And that strategic plan specifies a certain amount of assets to be in certain investment buckets, if you will. So as the stock market falls, if we are supposed to have, for example, 35% of our investments in large cap stocks, when the market starts to fall, we do some purchasing. Now, what this ultimately does is have the effect of buying low and selling high, because if the market goes up and we exceed our strategic plan, then we will sell stocks.
Bader wants participants of the PERS and TERS systems not to lose sight of the fact that these are long-term investments. While state employees should be concerned with short-term market conditions, the funds are designed to be built up over a typical career of around 30 years.
Their investment allocation is for long term. We have billions of dollars. If they are retirees, they should not be fearful that there's not going to be any money to be paying their benefits. We have billions of dollars in the system, and while we don't like to take losses, we take gains too. So I would rest more easily if I were a retiree to know that there are billions of dollars remaining in the accounts.
More PERS and TERS information can be found on the website of the Treasury Division of the State of Alaska Department of Revenue. In Dillingham, I'm Adam Kane.
The Amonik Women's Shelter is Alaska's only emergency shelter located in a village setting. The staff is comprised entirely of Yupik-speaking women from the community located at the mouth of the Yukon River. But as KNOM's Lorelei Kanin reports, the shelter is still searching for resources to reopen on an around-the-clock basis.
Shelter Director Lynn Hooch says they're doing what they can to meet the need.
We were getting funded from the state, but in 2005, the shelter was cut from state funding, stating that we were a rural program. We continue to do what we can to keep the shelter open since then. So the shelter has been open part-time, and we provide emergency shelter mainly to the people in Imanak. We do get long-distance crisis calls, and we accept those. And the women and children that call from the surrounding villages, we refer them to the shelter in Bethel.
The shelter was established in 1984 and has a history of providing safety to women and children victims in the Imanak region.
We were serving the five neighboring villages, Imanak, Alaknak, Katlik, Nunam, and Mountain Village, but we were also taking women in from Marshall, Pitkus Point, Pilot Station, Hooper, Scammon, Chivak, St. Michael's, Stebbins, and we were getting crisis calls from all over the state, even from the lower 48, just to talk to someone that would understand their situation. Native women would call in and want to talk with women here in the shelter, and all the shelter staff are Native advocates.
While the staff is dedicated to providing a safe haven for women and children, the current energy crisis is not helping. The shelter was built in the 1980s and has not been renovated since. Energy costs are making a dent in the budget.
The shelter is a 9-bed shelter, so it's a fairly big building, $400 or $500 a month for our lights, and we don't have that in the budget. I'm really fortunate that we got that tribal coalition grant that will be able to help us keep the shelter open and make sure the lights are on. And I'm so worried about the heating. We have a 500-gallon tank out there, and we normally fill that up every 3 months. I'm worried about how things are going to be this winter. We're going to do what we can to keep the shelter open.
Hooch says they nearly closed the doors after losing state funding 3 years ago, but the importance of the village setting and the native-run shelter could not be ignored.
I know we have 21 shelter programs within the state, and the majority of the victims that they provide services are Native women and children. I really believe that it's so important to have Native advocates in each of the programs so women that come into the shelter for services will be comfortable.
The Imanak Women's Shelter hopes that in February, the State Council on Sexual Assault and Domestic Violence will reinstate the grant that had kept the shelter open over its first 2 decades. If so, the shelter will once again provide around-the-clock service to women and children within the villages surrounding Imanak. In Nome, I'm Lorelei Kanin.
Fairbanks Police will use a new grant to better follow up on domestic violence cases. A $300,000 award from the U.S. Department of Justice will pay for a full-time investigator as well as domestic violence response training for local police. Project Director Lieutenant Tara Tippett says the investigator will be able to take on aspects of response police currently don't have time for, like reviewing domestic violence cases and reports.
So, for instance, if we have a home that we've gone to, say, 5 times, and we haven't made any arrests, and we've ended up closing those calls out as unsubstantiated because we didn't have other physical evidence and we didn't have cooperation of people who were there, and we just didn't have enough information, I would expect the person who becomes a DV investigator to note that pattern and maybe make contact with that family and offer them some services. Because obviously, if the police are being called back there over and over again, something's wrong.
Tippett says the investigator will also check up to make sure restraining orders are being adhered to and work with the district attorney's office to help prepare documentation for cases coming up for trial.
A lot of times, the victim has bruising that appears over a period of days or maybe even weeks, and it changes. And it's so important to document that. And with different schedules and people's days off, that's one of those little pieces that kind of falls through the cracks sometimes.
Alaska has a high incidence of domestic violence, and Fairbanks has one of the highest rates in the state, averaging more than 2 calls a day. Lieutenant Tippett says that the problem is on the rise.
Last year, we had over 850 calls for service for incidents involving domestic violence, and through August of this year, we were already at 612. Last year, I think we arrested about 360 persons for incidents involving domestic violence. This year, as of the end of August, we'd already arrested 251. So we're certainly on track to have more reported incidents and more arrests this year than we did even in 2007.
Lieutenant Tippett says it's unclear if there's more domestic violence occurring or if it's just being reported more often. She says alcohol is a common factor in most cases and that in many there have been instances of prior abusive or violent behavior in the family's history. Tippett says Fairbanks police hope to prove the value of having the domestic violence investigator on the force so that the city will fund the position after the two-year grant expires.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. Support for APR and coverage of the 50th anniversary of Alaska statehood comes from Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, operating and maintaining the Trans-Alaska Pipeline.
In January, the Alaska Board of Fisheries will consider several proposals to restrict or expand access to Dungeness crab in the waters off Prince of Wales Island. KRBD's Jay Marble has this report on how one community, Whale Pass, could be affected.
Over the years, some communities in southeast Alaska have introduced proposals to the Board of Fisheries to close their local waters to commercial Dungeness crabbing. Residents have argued that these waters should be left to locals so they can harvest the crabs from their skiffs and small boats for their dinner table. That was the case 6 years ago in Whale Pass, a community of about 56 people on the northeast side of Prince of Wales Island. Residents there submitted a regulation change to the Board of Fish, which ultimately closed the waters nearest to Whale Pass to commercial Dungeness crabbers. Daryl Donaldson lives in Whale Pass and is a former president of the Whale Pass Community Association.
It was a high priority of the community to get a set aside because the crab fishing in the inner bay, or the little small area that surround where the personal use people are, was basically just flooded with crab pots, commercial. Navigation of the skiffs back and forth to your house was difficult. The number of crab people were catching for personal use was way, way down. And it was a high priority.
Donaldson says the Whale Pass proposal was passed by the Board of Fish, and since then, commercial crabbers have not been allowed in those waters closest to town. Personal use crabbers and sport crabbing is allowed in those waters. Other communities have had similar proposals passed, proposals that cut out the commercial crabbers. All these communities, like Whale Pass, that have managed to block commercial crabbing might all be affected by one proposal that the Board of Fisheries will consider in January. This proposal seeks to take all those areas that are closed to commercial crabbing and also close them to sport crabbing. In other words, the waters would remain open to personal use crabbing by residents, but not to out-of-state sport fishermen. The Southeast Alaska Fishermen's Alliance submitted this proposal. Kathy Hansen is the CEFA director.
Through the last couple cycles previous to this one, there's been more and more proposals to close areas around town. And the justification has always been to have those closures for local residents. In the case of a lot of these closures, people have complained even after the areas have been closed that they still, you know, commercial crabbers are still there because they see all these pots and buoys. And if you go and check, a lot of them are from lodges nearby the area.
Hansen says this proposal has been offered twice before by the Wrangell Advisory Committee, which opted not to try a third time, so CEFA decided to offer the proposal. CEFA is offering another proposal. This one is specific to Whale Pass. This proposal would allow commercial crabbers back into the Whale Pass waters in the fall, but not in the summer. CEFA Director Kathy Hansen says a fall commercial season would not conflict with other user groups at Whale Pass because they're not in the water in the fall.
What we've done in this proposal is we're keeping it closed during the summertime. Commercial fishery. What we're asking is for it to be opened in the fall time when there usually are not, according to the crabbers that are down in that area, they say there is not a you know, any crab pots left in the water in the area because everybody has pulled their skiffs and don't work in the nasty wintertime weather, which I don't blame them.
Daryl Donaldson from Whale Pass says this proposal is likely to encounter a great deal of resistance from his community. He says the waters near town are heavily fished for crab by personal use and sport fishermen.
And it's been a boom locally. I mean, this is, if this proposal comes forward, I would not be surprised to see people from Whale Pass going to the board meeting, flooding the board with letters opposing the concept of reopening commercial fishing in this small piece of the Inner Bay. And it is a very small piece.
Dungeness and other Southeast and Yakutat shellfish proposals will be considered by the Board of Fisheries when it meets in Petersburg January 21st through the 27th. Those who want to comment on the proposals are encouraged by the Board of Fish to do so in writing at least 2 weeks before the meetings begin. Public testimony will also be taken at those meetings. I'm Jay Marble.
Alaska Airlines officials say their investigation into the cause of an emergency landing at Juneau International Airport last month has confirmed their initial suspicion: a circuit breaker tripped between the cockpit and one of the engines, causing an instrument panel, but not the engine, to stop working. KTOO's John Ryan reports.
Shortly after takeoff on the night of October 23rd, the crew of Seattle-bound Flight 66 noticed a system failure and headed back to Juneau. With emergency vehicles lining the runway, the jet and its 129 passengers landed without incident. Airlines have standard procedures for emergencies. Their crews and flight attendants are trained to handle such events. Their public affairs people sometimes describe an emergency after the fact like it was no big deal. Here's Paul McElroy with Alaska Airlines.
We take no chances. Safety is our number one priority, and that's why we always follow a certain procedure. And our priority is to get that aircraft back on the ground as fast as possible. And when flight crews declare an emergency, what that tells air traffic control is to get all other airplanes out of the way, give that flight number one priority to land, and most times it's nothing very severe.
Talk to someone who's been through such an emergency, and you can get a different picture.
It was a very frightening experience.
Laura Vidic of Juneau was a passenger on Flight 66. She describes what happened shortly after takeoff.
I noticed that we had leveled off and the captain hadn't gotten on the intercom yet, but he finally did and mentioned that they were experiencing multiple failures and that we need to prepare for emergency crash landing.
She says passengers followed the instructions of the flight crew and assumed the crash landing brace position.
They had said, put your arms in front of your face and lean into the seat in front of you, or if you can, lean down and grab your ankles.
Vidic says the cabin was surprisingly quiet.
You could hear people crying, and I think everyone was kind of in their own little headspace.
She says the lack of information provided to passengers made the experience more frightening.
What was going through my mind was, you know, is this going to be a water landing? Is this going to be a mountain landing? And then all of a sudden, you know, me and the passenger next to me saw the lights and we landed without incident.
Passengers got off the plane and were offered the chance to get on a later flight. Vidic says she decided to postpone her trip and remain earthbound for a while. Alaska Airlines says it replaced the malfunctioning circuit breaker and returned the Boeing 737 to service the next morning. In Juneau, I'm John Ryan.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at APRN.org. We had help tonight from Casey Kelly in Homer, Len Anderson in Anchorage, Adam Kane in Dillingham, Lorelei Kaneen in Nome, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Jay Marble in Craig, and John Ryan in Juneau. APRN's Dave Donaldson reported from Juneau. Our editor and producer is Annie Fite. Our audio engineer is Gooseberry Peter. John Profit is our webmaster. Our managing editor is Duncan Moon, and I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by Alaska Conservation Solutions, providing ways to measure your carbon footprint and reduce your energy consumption at AlaskaConservationSolutions.com. And by
Tech Cominco and the Red Dog Mine, encouraging listeners to tune into AK every weekend. Check your local public radio station for airtimes.
Miss our newscast today? Listen to APRN's Alaska Morning News, Economic Report, and News Nightly on the web at APRN.org.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.